Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I am a former middle school teacher. I'm a current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so that's what we talk about on this podcast. We talk about ideas and strategies. I share stories, practical advice, but also some of my big epic fails. And one of the things I love doing is telling stories, the stories of what worked, the stories of what failed. And I'm actually talking today with an expert on stories and on storytelling. His name is Antonio Sacre, and he is a published author. He's a phenomenal author. Here's a little bit about him. Since 1994, Antonio has been collaborating with teachers nationwide, developing programs to enhance multicultural literacy, student engagement in creative writing, and classroom management. And I think he is a phenomenal storyteller. He has this angle of being a multicultural author and storyteller. It's culturally specific, but also universally relatable, going back to that kind of older idea of both a, you know, the notion of mirrors and windows, right? He does a phenomenal job at both as an author. And so I'm super excited that I got a chance to talk to him. And here we go. Here is the interview.
All right.
We have with us here Antonio Sacre, who's going to be talking about the power of stories in education. I would love to hear, before we get started on that, a little bit about your own story and how you got into storytelling yourself.
Well, it's funny. My father is from Cuba and my mom is Irish American, born in Boston, where I was born. And my dad will say to me, I talk to him a couple times a week. He says, "Mijo, it's an amazing you make a living as a storyteller because you are like the 10th best storyteller in our family." So I come from amazing storytellers, you know, and in many ways, you know, I love to ask teachers and parents, who are those great storytellers in your family? And if you're the great storyteller, awesome. But if you're not, who was that person, right? So in some ways, I had it in my blood, but I wanted to be an actor. And in graduate school, I was studying theater and I was really pursuing that path. It's a huge part of what I did. There was a class I took that was literally a storytelling class. And I took it because there was no exams, there was no papers to write. All you had to do was just listen to stories. So I needed that break. It was a rigorous program. I was at Northwestern in Chicago. And turns out, you know, like life happens when, you know, you're making other plans. Storytelling was the thing that really called to me. And it really, I love theater and I still love watching theater and doing theater, but storytelling was sort of, one of my storytelling mentors actually says, you'll know you found your calling when people start calling. So I was pounding down doors as an actor and I was getting some jobs and not getting other jobs. But the you know, my final project in the storytelling class in grad school was to tell stories in front of kids. And for those 30 minutes, you know, watching, you know, all you teachers know this, you know, when you have them. And the second you don't, they are out. So like in the theater, the audience is, you know, politely clapping, but maybe they're checking their phone. Maybe they're thinking about their lists. So there's an immediacy, almost like a high wire act that I loved. And then sort of my big break happened when I was working in Chicago and the teachers found out that I could perform in Spanish. So I began to tell stories just in Spanish to the kids who were learning English and to the kids who were studying, you know, Spanish as a second language. So I became known as this bilingual storyteller. I was an entertainer in my early years as a storyteller, just, you know, really just how do you keep the kids sitting and listening, right? And silliness and fun. And I had a juggling story. But really the teachers, you know, and the principals who are paying for me to be there, like, listen, entertainment is great, but how are you educating these kids? And, you know, the teachers are the ones that said, oh, he's telling about his culture. It's a multicultural assembly in the 90s. That was huge, right? Oh, he's helping learn language. Okay, that's great. And as my career developed, I fell into children's publishing. Some of the stories I used to tell out loud became children's picture books. And then there's this interesting shift that happened in the early 2000s where there was no more time for entertaining stories. And, you know, all you teachers know, you have every minute is planned out for the whole rest of the year. And so I found that I wasn't doing as many, you know, assemblies where all the kids are sitting in the cafeterium. And the money, just to be frank, was in teaching teachers how to do what I do, which is sort of replacing me, but you know, for a year I was bitter about that. But then for the second year, I was like, wait a minute, I'm having much more impact helping teachers tell stories in the classroom 180 days a year than I am coming in once or twice to a school district and telling stories to the kids. I still do a mix of both. I still do performances for kids in schools, and I love that. But I've been sort of pushed and pulled into this professional development space. You know, I wasn't a teacher. I didn't go to education school. I really have just told stories for 30 years in the classroom, and I kind of know what helps engage a kid. And so, you know, I'm at this interesting space. You know, when I first started telling stories, it was just K-5. And I know that you're a middle school teacher. So they were like, hey, can you come and tell stories at middle school? And I said, sure, if there's money, I'm going to do it. And my storytelling friends are like, oh no, they're going to kill you. You better. And I showed up there and I was not ready for the stares you get from the middle school kids and silence, and they weren't laughing and blah, blah, blah. And then I'll never forget it. A kid came up to me afterwards and he was really looking around so nobody could see him. And he like whispered as quick as he could, that was cool. And then he kept walking, you know what I mean? And so I became known as a middle school storyteller. I was like, I was that guy. And then it led into, you know, performing in high schools and colleges. And along the way, I have been pushed into, you know, poetry writing, nonfiction writing, writing for older kids. I have my first middle grade fiction novel being rejected as we speak. That's part of my path too. So that's a little bit of my story. In some ways, really, it's coming from a family of storytellers and trying to share a little bit about my cultural upbringing, my Cuban Irish American upbringing. Like one of my friends calls me a leprechaun. So I'm a mix of these cultures. And as you know, I know that you said you did some work in Phoenix. You know, so many of our kids in the schools are mixtures of cultures. You know, a lot of them are first generation. A lot of them have extended family from all over the place. And, you know, it's sadly still true. When I was younger, you know, kids made fun of me for speaking Spanish. And in some places that's still happening. And, you know, I'm a model of, no, I have a career. I get to talk to people around the world because I have two languages and two cultures. So, you know, there's a bit of motivation there as well, but really at the core of it, you know, I'm trying to entertain kids and get them excited about their own family stories. All my books are about my own family stories. And so that's where I come from as a storyteller, especially in education.
We'll talk about
the
power story here in a second and what it means for teachers and their own stories. But one of the things I'm struck by is just the power you said of multiple layers of identity, right? And of intersectionality, and you know, it's not this person is Latino, this person is white. You know, the power of those, all of those types of things. And I'm just curious, what do you see as the value for students in getting stories that aren't just that singular cultural narrative?
So interesting. So, you know, there's all kinds of things. I grew up in the 70s and 80s in Delaware. It's a small little town in Delaware. And I never, you know, there was at the time, my dad said there was only one Cuban family in the whole state, you know, and now it's different. Delaware is a little bit much more multicultural. But, you know, growing up and not, you know, I was just thinking about this. One of the teachers I work with last week is doing a unit on music. And I remember listening to Celia Cruz and Tito Puente and Gloria Estefan when she was singing in Spanish in Miami, but never encountering it in Delaware. So I was like, oh, well, this is not normal. It's only the thing that happens with my grandmother in Miami. And I felt weird. I felt like I was not part of the narrative. You know, at the school dances in junior high, there was never any of that music. It was music I loved. I mean, I listened to the radio. And so it just felt like there's this otherness there. And I imagine what would have happened if, you know, my eighth grade teacher brought in Celia Cruz. And all of a sudden, I'm the expert. I can tell you what that song means. I can tell you when she recorded it. I know who was playing in the band. This is just part of, you know, so I think that there's great power in learning a little bit. Now, you know, dance is dance. And, you know, salsa is different from disco, but they're both super fun. Oh, you dance disco with your mom. I dance salsa with my grandmother. Now we have a connection point. You know, so I sort of practice what I preach. When I moved to Chicago, it was the first time I really got immersed in the Mexican and the Puerto Rican culture. I was very well versed in Cuban and Dominican on the East Coast, but I didn't know much about Mexican at all. And so, like, whoa, you dance cumbia and you have merengue and oh, who's this band you've got? Wow. Oh my gosh, I can't believe it. So, oh, it's just like Celia, but it's not like Celia. And so we have something to talk about. And even like we would laugh because I couldn't understand Mexican Spanish and they couldn't understand Cuban Spanish. And like, wait, where are your vowels going? So when you start to laugh with other people and understand where we have commonality, I think it creates an incredible culture of understanding. And then also where we're different, you know? So I loved, one day, I was talking about how Cubans celebrate La Noche Buena, which is the night yeah. before Christmas. And it's a huge party. And then a kid's like, oh, I celebrate Kwanzaa. And some kids, I celebrate Hanukkah. And then we created the perfect blend of the four grandparents, you know, a Jewish grandparent, African-American, Cuban, and Mexican, you know, so we could have two yeah. months of parties at the holiday season, you know? And so, and that became super fun. So I, you know, the phrase of, you know, mirrors and windows, you know, here's a mirror. This is what, oh, we don't dance salsa, but we dance whatever the dance is. We don't celebrate the night before, we celebrate the day after. We, you know, and so I feel like there's just great power there. Now, there's 100, in many of the districts I work in, there's 180 different countries represented, right? So how are you going to learn something about all those countries? I get it. I know that that's hard, but I've listened to a couple of your podcasts, you know, student-centered. What happens if that one kid from yeah. whatever the country is, you know, Mongolia or from, you know, Armenia or whatever it is, tells us about their celebration? You know, now they're the storyteller of the classroom and we get to see something different. And, you know, I think that there's great educational and great joy. You know, the thing about stories is that it brings everybody mm-hmm. together. You know, and I, as much as I love devices and as much as our kids are on these devices, the memories I had were when, you know, mom shut off the radio and told us a story, or when abuela shut off the telenovelas, the soap operas, and told us about how dumb my dad was in Havana, you know. And so these are the memories, you know. I don't know how much our kids are going to remember the video games they spent hours on, which are great. There's great distraction and manual, all this different things. So, you know, I don't know. I feel that's kind of part of it. And then lastly, you know, I'm curious. I'm a little bit of a scientist. I want to understand, like, oh, wait, how do you do things there? Wait, what is the food you eat? Who is that singer? Now with Spotify and all the devices, I can listen to your music tonight. You're from Armenia. What's Armenian music? Oh, I'm 1 second away from Armenian music. So this is really interesting.
I love kind that. Of where I love I that. Come from. Discovery element and I do love the fact that you brought up food and how that connects to story. You know, one of the benefits of teaching where I taught in Phoenix was we would always, as teachers, like the gift that we got were tamales. And I had never, you know, being in Arizona, I'd always had Mexican style tamales. And then we started getting more students who are from, say, Guatemala and stuff like that. And it wasn't just that, yeah, it's in a banana leaf or something. It's that there's a whole different story attached to the tamales, right? And the gift of food was always attached to a story, right? So you talk to the parent and the grandparent, you know, whoever that is, and they're not just telling you about the food, which I loved, right? Like I would always devour these things. But it wasn't just the food, it was the story attached to it. It was the memories, it was the way the ritual of the creating tamales every year reenacted that story, right? There was this deep ritual, which I just always found to be really powerful. And with that in mind, I'm just curious, when you think about this idea of storytelling and the power of story, what do you think makes stories so compelling and powerful in education? Why is it important?
It's so interesting. I mean, it depends. One thing is there's a lot of research behind this, and I would just encourage, you know, and all the spare time you teachers have, just go down the rabbit hole of the brain research behind storytelling. So there is an actual neurological thing that happens when you hear a story. We are hardwired for story. We learn to speak and you know, be part of the community just through the oral tradition. A three-year-old still can't understand the symbols on a page that a book is, but a three-year-old can express and she can talk and she can do all kinds of things because of this oral tradition that's in our brain. There's some researchers in Northwestern Hospital in Chicago. My storytelling professor put me in touch with this research, where they're researching coma patients. And a coma patient being told a story that means something to them from a valued family member or friend, there's part of their brain that lights up, even in a coma, that nothing else does. Music doesn't, the news on the radio or whatever it is. So there's a deep-seated evolutionary connection to storytelling. So, you know, just as a parent, I have two children. My son is 12 and my daughter is 9. I want their brain active. I want their dance brain active and their language brain active and their art brain and their science and their math. So there's a massive section of the brain that only activates through storytelling. I love movies, and the brain shuts down when you're watching a movie, which is awesome. You know, we're so busy. We need to shut our brain down sometimes. We need naps. We need to sleep well. And so we love movies. We watch movies and TV shows, but I want that brain, you know, just selfishly and personally, I want my kids' brains active. So, you know, a teacher in the classroom, you know, even if they've read that story, The Three Little Pigs, to younger kids, you know, 100 times, they know the story. When you put down the book and the pictures, you're now bang, the brain is lighting up. So I work with parents. I do tons of parent workshops every year. And I'm like, look, books are important. I hope you have a million books in your house. I hope they're reading, library cards. I hope that this is the thing. But more importantly, put the books down and tell stories to these kids. If you want to help your kids be better readers, tell them stories. If you want them to be more empathetic and empathic, tell them stories. There is the last thing I'll say with one of your podcasts, you're saying, what do kids geek out about, right? I totally geek out about the science of story these last 15 years, you know, is that there are mirror neurons. Basically what's happening is when I tell you a story about Jack and the Beanstalk, and Jack is scared and the giant is chasing him, the kid feels that scare. They feel that in their brain. They're connecting with me in a deep way through this story. Don't we want to connect with our kids in the classroom? We do. So you're connecting with their kids, you're activating their literacy centers, you're making their brains feel these things. You know, all this push for way more diverse narratives in classrooms, I love, as much as I love all the classics, because we're activating our brains in different ways, you know? And, you know, when a kid gets bullied, we've all been bullied, maybe not in that specific way in the book, but we feel that, oh, we want to do something, you know, we want to change it. I think there's great power in that, power for change. But then lastly, it's just fun. I mean, I'll never forget my history teacher in high school teaching me about World War II. And he was just like, Joe Sixpack is in the trenches. And he makes up this whole story about Joe Sixpack. And he's wearing an Eagles t-shirt because we're near Philadelphia. And like, and so I understand the trenches because of the story this guy made up about some fictional soldier. And I never forgot that lesson. You know, and all the times where, you know, the kids think, let's get the teacher off task. Let's get her telling stories. You know, yeah, let's also build community and build connection and increase our literacy centers. So I think that's kind of where that power is. But really what I'm really seeing the last few years, especially with the disconnection that we had with the Zoom stuff and, you know, the whole pandemic is the lack of connection that we have just in general. We're disconnected on our screens. We're disconnected because we're so busy. So let's connect. And how does that happen? So I think those are some of the things. But then lastly, you know, I also know how hard it is to be a kid and to just see them giggling. I told a jump story in a third grade yesterday where I'm getting really, really quiet, really good. And the goat jumps out of it and the kids all leap and they're laughing and giggling. And the teacher runs and gets her phone and she's videoing it because she's hasn't seen them like this. They're allowed to be silly and awesome. So, you know, as much as you can, and again, I'm just so aware of my wife and how packed her schedule is for the rest of the school year. You know, let's let these moments of levity and joy happen to build a more, you know, trusting classroom community. And then that makes it a little bit easier, you know, to teach. You know, that's the thing that even with my own kids, I want to lecture them all the time. And I'm like, you know what? Let me just connect with them first, and then I'm going to lecture them. They're going to get lectured, but it's better after this connection or this kind of story.
I was in my second year of teaching, and I'd become almost best friends with this other other social studies teacher. And, you know, I was doing some project-based learning things and a lot of things that were very student-centered. And I needed to just do some direct instruction, teach some things in social studies. And So my best friend on our prep period, we would often watch each other's classes and just observe. And it's probably the second week of school. And he observes, and his name was Javier. So I said, "Hey, Javi, tell me what was missing from my lesson?" And I remember he gave this advice, and I think it's so true. He said, "John, even if it takes another 5 minutes, quit giving examples and tell stories." He said, "Nobody loves examples. Mm-hmm. Everybody loves stories." And I've been struck with that all the time. You know, it's the same thing with, you know, giving a keynote. I'm going to tell a story, and that story might be 10 minutes long. You know, that story might be the link through the entire talk. Or, you know, I was struck by the notion that kids don't hate word problems, right? What they hate is that word problems are really bad stories. They lack conflict. They lack authenticity. You know, it's like, use the Pythagorean theorem to throw someone out at second base, you know, at second base from the catcher. That's not authentic. You know, it's like, there's no conflict to it. There's no mystery to it. There's no character development. And I was struck by, you know, even little things in social studies, again, telling the stories. I remember I wanted them to engage in some problem solving. And instead of just giving them a challenge and problem solving, I told it as a story, which is true. There's a story of why ships are buried underground in San Francisco. It's a fascinating story. And so I tell it as a story, and people discover it, and it becomes a story. I'm spending 5-6 minutes on just telling the story. And I'm telling you, it's what you're saying. It's that mirror neurons, that neurocoupling, they're all zoned in. And then I was like, "What questions do you have?" And they immediately, all these questions, well, you're going to have to come up with a theory why. And I was struck by both the power of the story, but also the notion that the class period itself became a story, right? There was this conflict, this mystery, this. And so I started doing, you know, 2 or 3 times a year, these history mystery lessons. And again, it's just anchored on that idea of the power of story. And like you said, just how valuable it was for shared experiences, how valuable it was for the making the learning stick, right? You don't forget it when it's in a story, because we remember things through stories, things like that. But I'm curious, for you, when you think about story, why is it important for teachers to share their own stories?
In some ways, I wish that I was the geeky, you know, researcher to have back research to back it up. I can only just see kind of what happens. I do a long-term residency I live in Los Angeles, and there's a school on the campus of UCLA, which is a lab school. And I'm really fortunate to be there 32 days a year. I'm there every week. So what I think happens, you know, with the teachers telling me this, when I first started, the teachers were saying that the stories that you tell got the kids very excited about whatever we were talking about, whatever folktale. They're rushing to the library. And they just started doing it for themselves. So there's a little bit of a model. So that in Los Angeles, there's a big Armenian population. And I told a Christmas story from the Cuban tradition. And the Armenian teacher said, "Oh my gosh, we have a story." And then she's telling her version of the story. And then the next week, she's taking the lace that they create during the time. And then she comes in with a folk song. So it unlocks all of these things. I guess what I think about specifically with teachers is, especially I work mostly with elementary school teachers when I'm doing the PDs, there's time built in at that level. There's transition time. Yeah. That's going from the rug to our desks, or from the desk to recess. And it's a minute. It's not a lot. And that's, their attention span is not that big anyway. Instead of like yelling at them to get in line, let's have a story about your crazy uncle, you know, Mark, or your whatever it is. So I feel like it's a way to, you know, sort of layer in crowd control. That's a huge part of what we have to do in school anyway. Instead of yelling at the kids, get in line, let's just tell them a story. Hey, get in line and you're going to hear the story, right? So I feel like there's some of that there. But I am understanding how these kids need a break too. I'm also aware that a lot of kids I work with, their parents are working so hard. They're not getting stories at home. And they're, you know, some of them are getting their stories you know, in different ways, in video games or online. And again, it's a very important tool, but it's also like, so let's help bring that oral tradition, which doesn't, you know, so many times, you know, teachers will say at all levels, oh, our kids will never sit for 45 minutes. I don't have puppets. I don't have props. It's just me. Like, why? And I'm not even, you know, I used to be young. Oh, at least he's a young guy, you know, and now it's like, I'm not. So it's like, no, I don't tell them. I mean, they've seen me, so they're going to hire me, but it's still like, no, they will sit and listen. It's so baked into what they've got. So one of the things I love is, you know, there's a simile and metaphor and all these things that teachers are teaching. And a lot of these kids don't know these old sayings, you know, a stitch in time saves nine, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush, a rolling stone gathers no moss. You know, some of us of a certain age grew up with these, and these kids are not. So now it becomes a whole vocab lesson and a science lesson. What about moss and where does it grow? And what is about rolling stones and gravity? And my grandmother used to say, you know, so I think that these become excuses to go into the lesson that mm-hmm. helps hook the kids. And then lastly, I want these kids to know that their own personal and family stories are so important. So you were mentioning tamales earlier. There's a very beautiful book called Too Many Tamales by Gary Soto. And all it is him talking about his aunties and his mom making tamales. And the conflict is they lose a wedding ring in the tamale. And that book is, I mean, it's a seminal book. It's been around for many, many years. But we need 100 more of those kinds of books. I'm not writing a tamale story. I eat tamales. I know them, but it's not me. So it's you. It's your kids who can do this. So let me share with you my Armenian story of how we celebrate that we have this lace because of this magical Christmas spider. And here's the song and here's the food we eat. What do you've got? Oh, you know, and so I feel like it's making the kids understand the magic of their own backgrounds. So now the kids go home and they're like, Mom, what, you know, why do we make tamales? Even you just telling that story, you know, a lot of kids don't have the story behind the tamale. They still make the tamales, but the mom forgot, or they're now younger and it was a different time, or that's not in the culture anymore. You know, one of my books is called La Noche Buena, a Christmas story, which was me interviewing my dad about how they celebrated Christmas Eve in Cuba, which they don't do anymore. They couldn't, it's not the same. They're not by the beach. They don't have the resources. They don't have the 50 family members nearby. So the story is just a memory. My dad sharing that memory with me, which I share with my kids, became a book 20 years later. Now, you know, not every kid is going to be a writer, but that connection with that history, you know, the teachers can model that. And then the kids can go, then it just becomes not even a home. I always give the kids homework after every lesson, every time I tell stories. Oh, see if your family makes something special for a special holiday. You don't have to do it if you don't want to. And the next week, five kids will come up to me. Oh, you know, my dad said that we did this big barbecue and it was amazing. You know, and it becomes a way that I'm connecting with these kids. You know, I guess that's the thing. I feel like how do we make more connection within the structure of where all the things you guys have to do, right? I'm definitely aware of that. And I feel like it's a slight shift, but I think it's possible.
You said, you know, not every student's going to be an author, and that's true. But I am struck as you describe that of just how important it is that as they grow into adulthood someday, you know, that they also do know how to be great storytellers. And I feel like great storytelling is taught for sure, right? We definitely teach some of those components, but it's also something that we do from witnessing it and modeling it and seeing it. And there's both, right? And so I was wondering if for a moment you could just speak to what do you see as the value of students growing into storytellers themselves?
You know, there's an old saying, you know, to a hammer, everything is a nail, right? And I'm the storytelling hammer, right? So I just see story everywhere. You know, you when you're on an interview, you have to tell the story about why you want to work at this place and why you're going to add to this. And, you know, if you're not, you know, the absolute top of your game, the LeBron James or the Usain Bolt, you know, you have to differentiate yourself. And, you know, we're unique, you know, we are known by the stories that we tell. And so, you know, part of me is, in avocation. You want to advocate for yourself. Well, why do you need a specific thing? Well, let me tell you a story about this kid was riding down our street and his bike fell in the pothole. And now the story makes me talking to my local council person. Oh, it's not just fix the pothole, you dumb guy. No, there's a kid who was riding her bike and she fell into the pothole and she had to go get stitches. In some ways, it's a way to get what you want. And I want a job. Oh, give me the job. I need the money. No, I love whatever the product is. When I was a kid, when I was a kid, when we were sick, my grandmother would take out this huge jar of vapor rub and she would slather it on our chest and the smell of You know what I'm saying? And the smell of that reminds me of my grandmother. Yeah. And I don't know. Who knows? Life is crazy. I can't imagine I'm going to sell vapor rub, but that's a story I would tell if I was, you know what I mean? So I feel like there's part of that. But also the thing about stories is when a kid is listening to a story, he's learning to listen. Don't we want more people who can listen? So, a story is complicated. I'm imagining, I wish I could hear that. That's why the ships are buried under, San Francisco, because we're listening, we're trying to figure it out, but we're listening. So this is a skill, as is pretty obvious, that we as a society need to work more on. You are simultaneously training listeners as you are telling stories. And then it's so powerful to have your own story be listened to. So one of the things I do in the classroom, it's hard because there's 30 kids. If I tell, I just told a story last week about, my dad taking off the training wheels. He took off one training wheel and then I said, I'm not ready to have this last one taken off yet, Dad. And he's like, okay, sure. And the next day I wake up, there's no training wheel on the bike. I'm like, Dad, where's the training wheel? I don't know what happened to the training wheel. Somebody must have stolen it. Someone broke in our house and stole the I don't know. He's gone. So, of course, 30 kids had bike stories, not training wheel stories. Not all of them had a dad from Cuba who, stole the training wheel and lied about it. But they all had a bike story. Now, in a classroom, if I listened to 30 stories and had them all had that, being listened to, the class period is over. So they turn and talk to each other. This is the turn, the pair share, the turn and talk. So now 30 kids are all chatting. When the principal walks by, it looks like mayhem, but they're all telling stories to each other. And I feel like that idea of being listened to is really important in a lot of ways. Back to the diverse narrative, when we see books about ourselves, we feel like we've been listened to. Publishers have said, no, a tamale story needs to be published. An Armenian story about the spider web needs to be published. So I have been heard. My group has been heard in some ways. So I think those are some of the thoughts I have about it. But and even just back to advocating. My son comes in. He's in seventh grade, and I demand a new controller for my thing. Versus, hey Dad, me and Felix were playing the other day, and he really beat my butt in this game because he's got this awesome controller. Well, now I'm like, oh. Now I know why you need the controller. You're not just being a jerk seventh grader. You're telling me the story, and it matters that you can play this football game with Felix online. And okay, now I understand. It's probably still no, but now I understand. And he feels heard. That. And he
there's
feels
an
understood.
Old. I mean, just my own background. Just thinking about how I grew up. I have kind of a Judeo-Christian background, and I still remember a story of this prophet. I can't remember his name, Nathan or something, that confronts the king, and he doesn't confront him telling him a list of everything he did wrong. He tells a story. And then the twist at the end is like a very like Shyamalan twist is that, you're that person. And I just remember hearing it as a kid and going, oh, you can speak truth to power when you tell a story, because you can't argue a story, And over time, I've thought so much about that notion of story, as you can't argue with it. Stories are nuanced. They're complicated. And it just seems to me that in an era of social media and echo chambers and all these like binaries, you're either this or you're that in terms of positions, the power of a story is it breaks through all of that, and it provides nuance and it develops empathy. And I'm just struck that if students are really good at telling stories, and like you said, listening to stories, I just feel like that's going to be better for society. and having an empathetic society.
I think so too. It's interesting you talked about that. There is a skill to it, and a practice to it, just like anything. And there is a time constraint that I'm aware of, like I've constantly said, but I do think that there's something to that. I do think that, you know, the more, if we're teaching good listeners and good storytellers, so that now that my son is in seventh, I'm thinking about this a lot. He's in a debate class right now in seventh grade, and they're trying to, you know, the teacher, she's amazing. She's trying to solve the divisiveness in the whole entire society right now through her seventh grade debate class. And why not? You know, back to stories like she's tilting at windmills, and where else does it start? You know, there's I just heard this, a Jewish thing, you know, if not me, then who, you know, if not her, who's going to do it? Right. So, I'm thinking about even as a parent, I know a lot of teachers I work with are parents as well. So my son came home the other day and he said, "Dad, I can make $5 tomorrow." I'm like, "Awesome. $5 is great. How?" "Well, this kid isn't going to do his homework because he wants to play video games. So I'm going to do the homework for him and he's going to give me $5. Now, I applaud his sort of like his initiative, and, you know, $5 for a seventh grader is $5. It's an ice cream cone with his friends. And obviously I want to be like, no, that's ridiculous. And then in higher levels, you're going to get fired or you won't be able to whatever. But instead I was like, "Oh man, did I ever tell you about my friend Jay Murphy in seventh grade?" He's like, "No, I'm talking about Jay." I'm like, "Oh, Jay was super smart, but he never wanted to study. So what he did is he devised a cheating system that took him hours to implement. I mean, he was just like writing on the back of rulers and doing all these things. And then, you know, he took the test the next day and he passed the test. But I was like, "Jay, how long did it take you to put together that cheating system?" He goes, "Oh, like 4 hours." I'm like, "Huh, I studied 30 minutes and I got the same grade as you did." And so my son loves Jay Murphy now. And he's like, "Wait a minute, why would you do something that takes longer, has worse consequences, and you don't learn it?" And, you know, I have to check it with my son. I'm fairly certain he didn't take the $5 the next day. Maybe he did. I don't know. And then I'll come up with another story, either a true one or a not true one. You know, I did connected over the weekend with my son loves to climb. He's doing indoor rock climbing. And he was in this competition to climb as many walls as you could. And I said, "Oh, Henry, I paid this really great climber to climb 30 walls for me. So I won the competition." He's like, "You didn't win the competition. That guy did." I said, "No, I paid him the $30 and I got the," and so without saying, you know, I'm like, "But didn't I become a better climber by paying this guy to climb for me?" "No, you didn't learn anything. You didn't climb at all." Oh, that kid is not going to learn. So he makes, I don't have to be the mean dad. I tell two funny stories to my son about this cheating kid and me paying this random guy, which obviously didn't happen. And now he's like, "Oh, now I see." Now, I don't know, maybe a lecture would have been better. My dad would have just said, "No, you're never going to do that. What do you mean? You'll get kicked out. You'll get expelled. You can get arrested. You'll never blah, blah, blah. Go on your permanent record." And instead, I get to connect with my son in a way that made us closer. And I influenced his behavior, I hope.
Gosh, it's getting me thinking about so many classroom applications, right? Just the notion of how storytelling really should be at the heart of how we do social emotional learning, or the way we approach, you know, classroom culture and disciplinary issues and things like that. What I'm curious about is kind of bringing it home here, thinking about the classroom. What are some very specific strategies that teachers can implement in terms of incorporating storytelling into their practice?
I think the most powerful thing they could do would be to think of who they were at that age, if whatever they're teaching. Now, for some of us, seventh grade was, you know, for me, that's over, 40 years ago. I don't remember. I mean, there's a couple of indelible memories I have from seventh grade, but there's a time when I could have listed every single kid in my seventh grade class. Now I can't, right? So there's a saying that the very first thing I ever heard in my storytelling class was, "All stories are true and some actually happened." So I think that if you are a teacher and you don't remember third grade, I feel like it's crucially important for you to tell your students, "Hey, when I was in third grade and I was learning," whatever they're learning in, you know, math, "I was learning addition. There was this girl next to me named, you know, Sarah Johnson." It doesn't matter if she existed or not, but I feel like you are saying to these students, "I see you. I know what it is. This is how I went through this." So if you don't have a backlog of those memories, or if your memories were terrible, or if you don't remember, it doesn't matter. make up a folktale of your own life when you were in third grade or seventh grade or high school or whatever it was, you know, and start to build a character base. I mean, there's a few characters from every class you could probably remember. They become your characters. Hey, you know, Matt Hammond said to me when in seventh grade that I should, you know, whatever it is. And so Matt becomes a fictional character based on my memory. So that's the first thing I would do. The second thing I would say is, you know, you mentioned it yourself, you know, basically I when I tell stories, when I teach stories, storytelling as a way to teach writing to kids, I say, listen, most stories have people, characters, a conflict and a solution. So how many of you know somebody? Everybody raises their hand. How many of you know two bodies? And their first grader's like, I know two people. How many of you know three bodies? I know. How many people do we know? So as adults, we have run across, if you think about all the teams and classes and teachers and colleagues and ministers and all these people, we know 100 people we could tell stories about. Kids, that number is pretty close to that too, really, if you think about the classmates and their teams and their whatever it is. So if you know somebody, you can tell a story. Teachers, if you know somebody, just tell a story about that person. But how does that story become vivid? Okay, where were you? Have you been, I asked the kids, have any of you been any place? Oh yeah, I've been places. How many of you have been two places? I've been two places. How many places have we been to? So now we've got 100 characters and 100 places. You have 100 stories you can tell. Now, I could just tell you about, oh, here's my grandmother. She's on this couch. The couch is really sweet and that leather. Awesome, awesome. The actual story is the conflict. A character wants something they can't have. I want another piece of flan. My grandmother doesn't want to give me another piece of flan. Oh, what's going to happen? So when you think about all the people you know and all the places you've been, when was the time that you wanted something you couldn't have? In seventh grade, Jay Murphy wanted to pass a test without studying. What did he do? Oh, let me tell you what he did. And then lastly is diving into the details. So, I mean, that anecdote about Jay, I haven't developed as a story as a writer, but now I'm going to have to like create. So on the back of the ruler with a little magic marker, he wrote tiny, 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 and he had to figure out. So when you get it, you dive into these details, it's the mystery. Does he get away with it? Does he not get away with it? And then lastly, the solution, or sort of where the stories can have the most power, is how did the character change? So the first story I ever told, and still kind of the core of my repertoire, was when I was made fun of for speaking Spanish, I stopped speaking Spanish. And I gave away this lifeline to my culture for a couple of years. And so I went to my grandmother and I sat on that little couch with her and the telenovelas were on and she shut off the thing and she said to me, you know, you have to speak Spanish, because this is what she said. Yo soy tan vieja que voy a morir en cualquier momento. She said, I'm so old I could die any minute. I've got a foot on a banana peel and my other foot in the grave. And if I slip, I'll be gone and you have to talk. So my grandmother gets me laughing and I realize, wait a minute, I don't want to not talk to my grandmother before she dies. And she died 20 years after that. But still, it was the joke we told all the time. So how does the character change? Jay Murphy decided he wasn't going to cheat anymore. Or Jay Murphy cheated and he got away with it. Or he cheated and he got kicked out. Or now he was president. Who knows? Like, whatever. So I feel like those are the elements that teachers can think about. Again, I just want teachers thinking about all the people they could bring into the classroom. So they can bring in their third grade classmates, their seventh grade classmates, their seventh grade teacher. I had a great teacher. I had a miserable teacher. I had a teacher who blah, blah, blah. And so now we're creating the connection. And then lastly, with the kids, I want them to think about, I know 50 people. I've been 50 places. I can write 50 stories. There's only 10 months in the school year. I don't even have time to write all the stories I could tell. And so I want them to thinking about that. I want them to be like, I am a storyteller and I am a writer and I can tell these stories. I can share these stories. And the last thing, which ties into a little bit with the rewriting, and that, you know, is when you start to add dialogue into the stories, you know, when you know, and you start to talk a little bit like that character. Kids don't have that ability, but we do as adults. You know, my mom's Boston. Hey, you come over here, you little scallywag, or I'm going to go, you know? And so like now we're engaging the students. So I love when teachers bring some of that into their stories. And also I will say that a lot of times we are part of our story. Oh, yeah. We don't think it's interesting. And then we share them and people are fascinated. You know, to a Cuban kid in Miami, everybody has a Noche Buena story, but in Delaware, nobody heard of Noche Buena. So now it's like, oh, now they want to hear that. So I think those are the things, just letting teachers and students know that there's just a wealth of stories that they have if they've just been out there. and then let's start to share them and see what happens.
Thank you so much. I know we've taken up a good chunk of your time today, and I just really appreciate your generosity and being willing to share some of your ideas, share some of your stories. And for folks who want to connect with you, what would be a great place to start?
The two places to connect with me are on Instagram. My name is Antonio Sacri. You can just find me with my name. And my website, antoniosacri.com. And that on there, you can find links to, I have many albums of my stories that stream for free. I'm on Spotify, so you can get all my stories on Spotify. Many teachers use my stories in the classroom. Again, I love when they use my stories. I'd rather they use their own stories, but you can play one of my 5-minute stories or 10-minute stories during, you know, reading time or whatever it is. And then lastly, I'm doing a lot of both online and in-person professional developments. And you can get information about that on my website. Many states are giving CEU credits for teachers if they take some of my classes, which is a new thing for me the last couple of years that, there's a saying, there's nothing bad that something good doesn't come from it. That the pandemic pushed me online in a way that has increased my impact, which has been really great. And so, so those are the two places. Thank you so much, John. I really appreciate being a part of your podcast.
Well, there we have it. That is Antonio Sacri. Again, a phenomenal children's book writer and storyteller, and also does professional development with teachers. Again, thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. Would you do me a favor? If you like what you hear on this podcast, would you leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts? And will you tell another teacher about us? That's one of the best ways for people to find out, is through word of mouth. So again, thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day, and go out and make something awesome.